Hey folks, Scott Weingart here. I'm so sad right now, and all of my friends in the phone world are so sad because today we've lost John Hines. It's the 4th of July, 2015, and one of our great friends has been killed after a motorcycle crash. John was one of the most wonderful people I knew in medicine. He was kind. He was an amazing doctor, strong and confident in what he believed was right, but the consistent trait noticed by all those who met him in the foam world was his rare humility. John was just a lovely person. He had an acerbic wit that kept me in tears every time I was around him. He was just one of those people that made you feel good. He was trying to better trauma care in Northern Ireland, and hopefully his work will be continued and his amazing contributions remembered. My thoughts are with John's family. He left us far too soon, and I miss him so. If you want to send condolences to John's family, the best way to do it is to reach out to Rob McSweeney. You could tweet him at CritCareReviews, or just search for his name, or go to the show notes at mcrit.org/153. What I did yesterday to make me feel just a little bit better was I listened to all of John's talks, and it did make me feel better because every time I listened to John talk, I laugh. So one of the talks that I listened to was a recording of when John visited us for Grand Rounds at Stony Brook this past year. And the audio quality, entirely my fault, was crap. And so John and I had planned to re-record this as a podcast at some point. But since that can't happen now, and there might be folks out there who also we'll take some solace in listening to John talk. I want to put it up here on the podcast. Hopefully the audio quality won't bother you and it'll be overwhelmed by the incredible quality and humor in John's talk. And so this is how John Hines ran his unit.
So how I run my unit. This is more a talk about how we run our unit. We're a team of six guys in our intensive care unit. Hospital's about the same size as Stony Brook. ED falls about the same, so about 85,000-90,000 people a year. And this is a little talk about the idiosyncrasies in our unit, because intensive care consultants are all bonkers. They all veer off in different directions, and they all do things that are a little bit strange. It's a bit about our unit philosophy, a little bit about pragmatism, some voodoo science, which really doesn't have much basis in evidence, and what to do if there is limited or no evidence for some therapists. It certainly isn't for everyone. What we do in Craighaven doesn't sometimes cross over into other units. So just because I'm telling you we do something doesn't mean that it's right for you guys either, because you'll have your own philosophies and things. Who knows who this is? That's Rob McSweeney. Rob runs Critical Care Reviews. Rob and I trained at the same time. We came through at the same time. The stuff that we do in Craighaven drives Rob insane because there's no sound evidence base for some of it. It just seems like a good idea, so it drives him crazy. So talk for today, a bit about taking upstairs care downstairs, which is Scott's mantra, and a little bit about taking it outside as well. A bit about how to limit choices and standardize approach. And Scott talked about airway stuff this morning, about streamlining it to doing the same thing for patients. So I'm not going to talk about airway, I'm going to talk a little about our approach to central lines and inotropes. About how to aggressively de-resuscitate someone once the dust has settled, once their septic episode is over, how you actually get them off the vent and push them on, and how to treat patients as people and demedicalize once you've done all the cool and sexy stuff. So this is the big problem we have in the UK and Ireland. This is the number of ICU beds per 100,000 population. So I said that our hospital is about the same size as Stony Brook. We get the same ED throughput. We have got 10 ICU beds. We can only ventilate for 8 of those. The other 2 are HDU. And the UK in general has about 4 ICU beds per 100,000 population. Our average length of stay is about 2 days. We put 1,000 patients a year through. So it is fairly hefty going. It's fairly hot and heavy. This is our hospital. This is Craighaven. Center of excellence that it is. Our infrastructure is not good. This is inside the front door of our ICU. We have had the same bits of duct tape on the floor that's holding down the lino for about 5 years now. The duct tape periodically gets changed. So we do have to ration money. We've got a small pot to work from, and we have to decide what therapies we're going to deliver with that money, and new flooring isn't one of them. Classic example of this, our sedation policy is propofol and morphine. We've got targeted weaning using RAS scores. The nurses do their own thing when it comes to weaning. And the question we got asked a couple of years ago, the remifentanil reps came in and they were pushing remi really hard. You know, we should use this, it'll reduce your ventilation time, it'll improve your sedation protocols. If we introduced remifentanil and changed from morphine, it would cost us £1 million a year to do that. So we have to take a pragmatic approach to some stuff in our ICU, and spending £1 million a year on remifentanil isn't something that we were keen to do. So we try and do the simple things well. We use simple drugs and we have good sedation policies, rather than trying to use the fancy drugs to do things slightly worse. As far as I'm aware, we were the first people in Europe to dialyze, though. So although we save money on using simple drugs and generic drugs, we spend it on other stuff that we feel works for us. So we dialyze quite early and we dialyze quite a lot. Craig Adam, we were one of the first in Europe to do it because our chief physician was a previous renal physician before he saw the light and changed to critical care. We do CO2 dialysis. We're the first place in Ireland to get our own CO2 dialysis. We use Novalung. We do it early for any of the respiratory failures, and we cannulate ourselves. And we do run that quite a lot if people are failing on vents, get them off quickly.
John, can you just... Yeah, you can explain what that is, because I don't think these guys know what CO2 dialysis is.
Okay, so CO2 dialysis is essentially a semi-permeable membrane that gets rid of carbon dioxide. It's an extracorporeal circuit. We use the Novalung, and you can use it for VV or VA. And it's a little bit like ECMO light. So all it does is get rid of the CO2. You can oxygenate a little bit, but not that's clinically significant. What it does allow us to do is drop the ventilator volumes right down. So you can run these people at 2 mils per kilo tidal volumes. So if they're difficult to ventilate, you know, the difficult COPDs, the difficult asthmatics, you know, the tight anaphylaxis that you can't break, CO2 works really well for them because it takes the ventilation out of the equation. All you have to do is get some oxygen in there. So we use it quite a lot. We've been quite impressed with it. We've only done a few cases. We've been quite selective on who we do it all, so we haven't just rolled it out for everyone, but we're getting more and more experience with it. We have a fairly pragmatic approach to resuscitating in the ED. We were the first place in Ireland to do REBOA. We're the only centre, we're one of the only centres in the UK that offers it. We haven't done that many of them either, but we do have it available. So we're fairly forward-thinking. We've also got telepresence. We look after a couple of smaller hospitals that are out in the peripheries that don't have critical care. So we can do off-site ward rounds, look at patients that are coming into to peripheral EDs, and we can repatriate them back to us if need be. So this is Dr. McAllister, one of our chief consultants, working the robot there. Now, we don't always get it right. In about 2004, we bought molecular absorbance, which is dialysis for liver, essentially. This is albumin dialysis. We used it for about 5 years before we realized that actually it was crap, and it sort of sits in the corner of the room now, under a dusty sheet. So we don't always get it right. We are early adopters of a lot of therapies, but we don't always get it right. Sometimes we back a tough one. Critical care and ED resuscitation back home is a little bit different than the way it is here. The concept of resuscitationists tends to go more towards ICU. So this is a fairly typical trauma code in our place. Our ED consultants, there's one here checking blood products, and there's one here on the phone to radiology. Everyone else you can see around the bed space is either an anesthesiologist or an intensivist. So there's still a bit of a mindset back home that we're trying to change, where the guys that do the acute resuscitation tend to be anesthesia and intensive care. We're still trying to get around and get the ED guys doing more and more. So that's slowly changing, but at the minute, trauma codes tend to be ICU and anesthesia. And
do you have emergency medicine there?
We do have emergency medicine. It's much less procedural than it would be here. So we do have emergency medicine consultants. They do procedural sedation, cardioversions, and fracture reductions is about as far as a lot of them will go. The training program changed about 5 years ago, so everybody that does emergency medicine does 2 years of emergency medicine, acute medicine, anesthesia, and critical care, and then they go into EM. So we've got a cadre of people that are coming through that are resuscitationists, but we haven't got a critical mass yet. So this is still very often what happens. So this is a trauma code run essentially by intensivists in the ED, which would probably be unheard of, I would have thought, in most places in the States. We do our own thoracotomies. This is the last penetrating trauma thoracotomy that I did. This guy was involved in an argument over a football match. You can see a couple of stigmata. He's got a penetrating injury on his left clavicle, and he's got a Chelsea Football Club tattoo, which was the cause of the whole thing. So I think it probably would be a bit of a surprise if an anesthesiologist came down to the ED here and cracked the chest. Would I be right in saying that? So, but it's kind of par for the course back home. The last five thoracotomies done in our place were all done by anesthesiologists or intensive care docs. And this guy did very well. This is day two. He's neurologically intact. He's pulling a silly face with the camera, believe it or not. So we do a lot of our own resuscitating ourselves. It's a busy hospital, and we get quite a lot of trauma. This is a five-person RTA, all of whom are being intubated and ventilated at the same time. This is one of the patients that's been picked up by us as a pre-hospital service. And it's quite a nice sort of slide to show how our pre-hospital outreach makes a big difference, because all three patients arrived into the hospital at the same time. The one that we were involved with has already had binder, thoracostomies, tranexamic acid, neurocritical ventilation, and there's not actually anything happening around the bed space. Whereas the other two guys that have come in have needed all that work to start once they've hit the ED. Sorry.
So you have a 10-bed unit and you just got five patients.
Patients. So. It's a busy night ahead. So the pre-hospital sort of retrieval program that we have, which goes out to RTAs within a certain defined space.
What's an RTA?
A road traffic accident, sorry. Motor vehicle collision would be the terminology. So we bring these patients in already packaged, and you can see Fred here has gone and got himself a cup of tea, actually, which shows how well the system can work. So we do run a pre-hospital fellowship program for our guys. Cliff and Scott talk quite a lot about stress inoculation. We find that the fastest way to bring a senior trainee up to speed in resuscitating is to send them into the pre-hospital environment and to teach them in the field. Because if you teach them how to run airway algorithms, trauma codes, thoracotomies, ROBOA, if you teach them all that outside, it's very easy to make the transition back into the ED. So we take one trainee a year, run them as a pre-hospital fellow, send them out to work with the ambulance service and teach them the pre-hospital field. We run high fidelity simulation for them, so they get one sim a week and one day out with the ambulance per week, and it allows them to sort of refine those skills in the pre-hospital field so they can bring them back. This is one of our thoracotomy mannequins. You can see it's a little bit MacGyver-esque. It's mostly duct tape and meshes, but it teaches you how to do interventions rapidly and using the equipment that you would do in hospital. We run simulations like this one. This is an actor inside the car that's had a pseudo-impalement. So he's wearing an old bulletproof vest with a board through it, and it's out through the back of the seat. So we send the guys out to teach them trauma resuscitation for difficult cases like this, and it gives them a fabulous idea of the mechanisms that go on behind trauma and how to deal with these things in the pre-hospital field. So now you're probably thinking, that seems fairly unlikely, let's be honest. You know, an impalement with a metal fence or wooden fence through the car, it doesn't seem very likely. 6 weeks after we ran that sim, this lady crashed her car about 4 miles from the hospital. You can see it's the first frosty morning of the year, always a busy time for us when the weather changes. This lady lost control of her car, went through a wooden fence, and impaled herself. So this wooden fence post went in one side, through her spleen, through the top of her abdomen, out her liver, out the far side, and out through the door of the car. She was fully awake and talking. We sent out one of our pre-hospital doctors, because this lady isn't being scooped and ran with, because you can't. She's stuck. And this lady's dying process has started, and even though she's time critical, she's not going anywhere until that can be safely extricated. Training people for the worst case scenario and allowing them to do those interventions during simulation in real time works really well when you have to send them out into the field. So he went out to this lady, and you can see it's almost exactly the same as the sim that we ran a few weeks earlier. Same extrication, roof off, and cut. Whenever we were building the simulation, we thought, what's the worst case scenario? Someone impaled, trapped in the car. But This lady was also 12 weeks pregnant. So you can never quite predict how bad it's going to be. God will always throw you a curveball whenever you think you've got it figured out. So this has started a little bit in the States. I was talking to Scott earlier. Shock Trauma now have go teams that can attend scene. So scoop and run versus stay and play is an argument that's been debated in EMS for years and years. There's some people who are already started the dying process. You cannot scoop and run. Sometimes you have to bring the interventions to them. This lady and baby are both doing very well, you'll be pleased to know. So we try and have a fairly unified approach to resuscitating in Craigavon. One of the things we do is we try and get everybody to do things our way. We regiment it quite tightly. So although people bring lots of experience to the job, we try and get them to do it our way and teach them our way to do it. So we have a fairly unified approach to central lines. We do exclusively subclavian lines in Craigavon unless they're completely medically contraindicated. So everyone, if they're getting a central line, has a 20 centimeter, 5 lumen, left-sided subclavian line inserted to the hilt, unless it's medically contraindicated. A few reasons for this. We find that the subclavian lines are infected less than any other lines. It's debated in the literature. IJ and subclavian seem to be about the same. Femoral lines are a little bit more dirty, although there is conflicting evidence on that. But we stick to subclavian because it gets people used to putting in subclavian lines. So subclavian lines are the resuscitative lines of champions. So what we want to do is train our guys up so that they can do 100 subclavian lines in a year, and they're very confident banging those things in. So when you do get the trauma patient in that needs a cordless sheath put in a hurry, and there's no scanner in hand, these guys have already done 100 of them under controlled environment in the ICU. So we exclusively stick to subclavians. They're all 20 centimeters long. They all go into the hilt. So there's only one suture point. It doesn't have the little hub clicked on, and they're not drawn back to 16 centimeters, and there's not bits flapping in the wind. So the line doesn't piston in and out whenever the patient moves. So it's quite a clean line into the hilt, one suture point. What we also do is we attach our drugs in a very certain order. Forgive me if I'm preaching to the converted here, but we put the CVP in the most proximal port. So the line goes in, CVP gets hooked onto the proximal port, and you immediately know if your most proximal port is in a central vein or not. If your CVP port on the proximal port is a CVP trace, you can assume that everything downstream of that is safe to use. It also gives you a good indication if you take the patient to the scanner or you're moving them about. If the CVP trace disappears on the monitor, you know that the line may be on its way out. So it's the first sign that the line has moved. And then we start with the scariest drugs most distal. So the noradrenaline goes in the distal port, sedation goes back one, fluids goes in the big port. So we have a very unified approach. So our elective, if you like, central lines in the unit are done in a way that gets people used to doing a resuscitative line. So if they're putting in a line for inotropes in the ED, they're already, their muscle memory is left-sided subclavian, straight in, CVP on the distal port, noradrenaline down the proximal port. And it's what they've done day in, day out for their year with us. So they get very good at it. So there's no thinking, there's no cognitive load, because they've all done the same thing. The advantage of putting the sort of elective lines on the left side is that it leaves the right side free. So if you need to put a resuscitative sheath in, or you need to put a dialysis catheter in, it leaves the right side free, which brings me on to CRRT lines. So we also put subclavian lines for our dialysis patients for the same reason. It gets people used to putting big lines into the right subclavian vein. The advantage of this is there's only a single 90 degree bend to reach the SVC in the right atrium. So your flows are really good because the line's only making one turn as it goes into the central vein. The femoral site we ban. We just don't give it as an option to people because then they can't pick it. If we come in and find a femoral line is in, that's fine as long as there's a reason for it. So we just ban it completely. We take it out of the equation. All our dialysis site lines are 20 centimeters long. They all go into the hilt. They all sit pretty much in the heart, and they're chosen for optimal, reliable flows. So we dialyze quite heavy in Craigavon, so our lines have to be spot on. This is how not to do it. This is a right-sided IJ dialysis line that's been put in. You can see about 5 centimeters just hanging out, flapping in the breeze. There's been 6 points that the line's been sutured at, so there's all those little portals for infection in and around the line insertion point. This line's flow rate isn't going to be great. It's made a full 180 degree bend the way it's been sutured on, and if the patient moves their neck during dialysis, there's a good chance that the CRRT circuit is going to stop and have to reset. So this is how not to do it. So we try and pick our lines very pragmatically. So central lines, we do between 800 and 1,000 a year. We've had no Lyme-related infections for the last 5 years, which is when we started really tight surveillance on it. They're left in as long as necessary. We never routinely change the central line, so they'll stay in for weeks if they have to, as long as there's no signs of infection. Our pneumothorax rate is very low. It's about 0.8% over the last 200 or 300 lines that we've done, which is lower, as far as I'm aware, than any published figures. And we teach a very didactic method of putting in the lines, so with the minimum number of hand movements. And if you've watched Scott's video online on MCRIT, it's pretty much the same technique that he does. So needle straight under the clavicle, single hand movement. Left hand doesn't leave the chest when you're doing the line. And it's very, very reliable. Our lines tend to sit quite far in. A large portion of them will be in the right atrium. With the soft catheters, we've had no problems with cardiac erosion ever. So the concept of having a line sitting in the heart being loosened just doesn't hold true. So about 10% of our lines will sit intracardiac, and we don't change the line position unless there's an arrhythmia. So they all sit in the heart.
When an ICU patient gets a fever, how do you decide what's your decision making in terms of whether the line might be the cause?
So we usually pull a sample from the line, and if it's a sterile sample, we'll leave the line in unless there's evidence of infection at the port site. And if we do suspect, we'll take the catheter out and send a tip for confirmation. So we screen it quite tightly because we don't want to miss any, but we just haven't had any. So an example of how we treat sepsis, just to let you know what our sort of thought process is, and some of this is a bit controversial, it's not for everyone. So everyone that we have that's septic is an art line. We all get an art line so that we can do serial lactate measurements. We don't tend to go by venous gases once we get them into the unit. We all get an art line. Everyone gets a central line, a little bit controversial, but we try and reduce the number of central or the number of extraneous infection points that we can. So any peripheral cannulas they have all get taken out. If they've got a line that we've put in the ED or someone else has put in the ED, it gets taken out. They get a fresh line under controlled conditions, optimal conditions, unless someone can swear in their life that the ED line was completely sterile. Everyone gets an inopressor. The only agents we use in Craigavon are noradrenaline and adrenaline or epinephrine, same as we're in this side of the Atlantic. No one gets an inodilator. And we get a little bit concerned once we hit about 2 liters of fluid. So once they've had coming up to half their cardiac output and fluid loading, we do a structured reassessment of them all to make sure that we're not missing something. So we don't fluid load them hugely. They get about 30 mils per kilo, and then we have a strong word with ourselves if we're not winning by that point. So you won't see this in our place. You won't see liters and liters and liters of heartburn pouring into people without some sort of endpoint in mind. Because once you've given 5 liters of heartburn, you've essentially given their entire cardiac output. If their blood pressure is still crap at that point, you have to question yourself, what am I doing here? So stuff that's banned, we don't use etomidate. I know the evidence has almost come full circle in this with the last Cochrane review, which has now brought into question whether it does not influence mortality and sepsis, but we just outright banned it in 2002. We took it off the shelves, so you can't get it nowadays. But ketamine's very readily available in Craigavon. It's a Class B drug in the UK, which means that it's illegal to sell, but it's legal to use. So there's no special requirements for stocking it. It can be sitting out in the open shelves. So we use ketamine pretty much for all of them. All the inodilators are banned because we're quite a dry unit. If you try and inodilate a patient in our unit, you'll almost certainly kill them. So we've got no dibutamine, no anoxamone, no melrinone, nothing like that. So we exclusively inopress them all. Phenylephrine and metaraminol are also banned. The reason for that is that because our resuscitationists are mostly anaesthetists, we've got quite a mixed bag. So some of them are interested in resuscitating, and some of them do it because that's what they're being paid to do. So some of the guys that are quite junior will come along and they'll treat every critically ill patient as if they're doing an appendectomy on them. So they'll all get 400 milligrams of thiopentone, 100 of Sux, classic RSI, and then they'll get their blood pressure brought up with metaraminol or phenylephrine if you let them away with it. So we just outright ban them, and then it means that they can't do a lazy resuscitation. So they can't have someone that's they're incrementally dropping their cardiac output, incrementally increasing their pressor. So they're getting a pure vasopressor, dropping their cardiac output, and simultaneously pouring in 5 liters of fluid. That's how badness happens. So we just take all that stuff off the shelves, and that way they can't use it. Non-rational fluid therapy is banned, so there has to be some sort of rational approach. We use echo and transesophageal echo as well, for anybody that's got difficult views. All cardiac output monitors are banned until someone can come up with a plan to build one that actually measures cardiac output. So if someone comes up with a perfect cardiac output monitor, we will use it. But at the minute, we find that it just confuses people. So they end up doing the wrong thing. So we just outright ban them unless there's someone there that knows how to use them. So this was a question I asked of my five colleagues before I left here. When was the last time you diagnosed ARDS in one of our patients in ICU? And everybody did the same thing. They all went, can't remember. So the responses were somewhere along the lines of maybe one of the swine flus. Can't remember. There's someone with pancreatitis, I think, maybe a few months back. Some of the patients we get transferred in will come in with ARDS. And interestingly, whenever we tried to recruit for the HARP2 trial, we couldn't find anyone with ARDS to put into the study, so we had to pull out from it. So we don't really see ARDS in Craigavon at all. If you screen for it using, you know, either AACC or Berlin consensus, our incidence is about 0.8%, and that's almost exclusively patients that have come in from somewhere else or have had swine flu. So our incidence of ARDS is incredibly low, and our feeling is that most ARDS is actually heart failure by another name. So our incidence of ARDS is very low.
Do you not see any trialing?
No, we don't see any trialing.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because of this, they get aggressively deresuscitated once they get over the hump, so we don't have any trialing. We'll get some that responds to diuretics almost instantly, which makes it not trialing technically, but yeah, we haven't seen any of that. So how to aggressively deresuscitate? Deresuscitation seems to be a new and fashionable term. If you've listened to John Myberg's or John Marshall speak about it, you'll hear him talk about deresuscitation. You'll also hear Marek talk about it a little bit if you listen to some of the podcasts online. It seems to be the fashionable new thing to try and dry people out once the fluid load is over with. But we've been doing this in Craigavon for at least 30 years or so. And we are a lot more hardcore when it comes to deresuscitation than some of the techniques that have been mooted. So this is what we do. So fluid resuscitation in a critically ill patient is a concept of ebb and flow. So there's no doubt that they need fluid loaded when they come in. You know, there's no question. Once you get up to 5 liters, you should discuss with yourself, what am I trying to achieve here? But once they're over the hump, once you've got source control, they've had their antibiotics, their inotrope requirements are coming down, you have to do something. So rational fluids for resuscitation are good, but if you've given that person 5-10 liters of fluid, and now they're back on an even keel, that fluid is bad for them, and there's no question about that either. Fluid loading is bad if you just do it empirically. And the danger is that you get into the heroic aspects of resuscitation, where you pile the fluids in, you get the blood pressure up, pressures are down, lactate's normalized, and then you kick back and think, well, the patient can sort that fluid out themselves, they're fixed now, and we'll give them a couple of weeks and they'll pay it out. So the danger is that you aggressively resuscitate and then you don't de-resuscitate. So this is something that we push quite hard back in my shop. So the general aims and principles: once you've turned the corner, we try and get the person euvolemic, and generally that means a negative fluid balance. So we try and get them back to a point of euvolemia. We use diuretics if their kidneys will allow us, and we use lots of diuretics. If diuretics don't work, we dialyze them, and we'll dialyze them, we'll take off up to 600 mils an hour if we have to, if they're completely anuric. So we aim to really get the fluid out of them and get euvolemia very quickly. I think everybody would agree that if someone is euvolemic or hypervolemic, there's no place for IV fluids. So it does drive us crazy if we find that people have been put on 125 mils an hour apartments and furosemide infusion. It just doesn't make any logical sense. So once they've reached the endpoints of the resuscitation, all the fluids come down and then we reassess. And if there's scope for de-resuscitation, that's what we do. Electrolyte abnormalities are harmful and must be treated. Now, whether those are causative or whether they're just reflective of critical illness, we don't know, but we don't tolerate them. So we know that people that are hyperchloremic, people that are hypernatremic, people that are hyperglycemic all do worse. We don't know if it's because they're hypernatremic, hyperchloremic, hyperglycemic, or if it's just the canary down the mine shaft. But what we do is we treat them aggressively if we find them. So our strategy, we limit choices again. There's only two diuretics relevant to critical care: furosemide and potassium cammionate. Potassium cammionate, I don't know if you can get it over here. It's essentially IV spironolactone. So we use a combination of these two. We go big with the furosemide. We generally start at maybe 50 milligrams IV. If that doesn't work, we double the dose, and we continue doubling the dose until they're getting about 2 grams a day. So we go pretty big with our furosemide drugs, furosemide doses. Furosemide is the safest drug in the world. It really is a wonderful drug. You will not cause any problems giving someone 30 milligrams per kilogram a day of furosemide.
And they still hear after that.
They still hear, yeah. We have had one that had hearing loss, but they were also getting 6 milligrams per kilogram of Gent at the same time. So we infuse it over about half an hour, and it is safe. We learn from our mistakes. So if we don't achieve it with furosemide, we add in some potassium carbonate, which is IV spironolactone. We get it imported from Germany. We do get some complications with furosemide, and you should be able to anticipate these. So the main complications are metabolic acidosis, alkalosis, hypernatremia, and hypokalemia. Those are the three big ones that we get with furosemide. And most of the deresuscitation strategies that are being bandied about would have you back off at this stage. They would say that you've reached the end point. You know, this patient's now so dry that you can't continue with your aggressive deresuscitation. And that's nonsense. All you have to do is fix these, and you can push on as hard as you want. So alkalosis, this is a direct lift out of our ICU manual. Unfortunately, our trust won't let us put this up online, but this is essentially what we teach our trainees. So we would define a significant alkalosis as a base excess of more than +6, and it's unphysiological. The body's very good at dealing with acidosis. That's what it's built to do. It's terrible at dealing with alkalosis. So a minor alkalosis causes big problems physiologically, so we don't tolerate it. Underlying cause is rarely possible to elicit and treat quickly. So what we do is fix the numbers. So the first thing we do is check their urinary pH. If it's low, if they're already offloading as much acid as they can, we give them some acetazolamide. So what we do is we get them to pass bicarbonate as well. If their urinary pH is not as low as it could be, we give them hydrochloric acid. And the first time we infused intravenous hydrochloric acid into a patient in Craigavon, pharmacy went apeshit. So we got this 0.1 molar hydrochloric acid that you have to be careful with it, because if you spill it in yourself, you're in trouble. But it sits about the place. And what we do is we work out their base deficit times their weight times half, and that's the amount of hydrochloric acid that they get. So they get this down their central line. It's also fantastic if you've got a blocked port in your central line. IV hydrochloric acid is the answer. We'll occasionally use the NG stuff if they don't have a central line, but to be honest, it never happens. So if they get a metabolic alkalosis, they get an infusion of acid until it's fixed, and then you can push on with your deresuscitation. So hydrochloric acid, it is dangerous, but used appropriately, it's a wonder drug. It works really well at fixing the numbers and allowing you to push on with your resuscitative endpoint. Hypernatremia is another one that we see. So what's the main cause of hypernatremia in ICU?
Either excessive water loss or given the heartburn.
Yeah, so it's free water deficit. So the main thing about hypernatremia to recognize is that it's an absence of free water, and you should treat it appropriately. So we start when the sodium hits 147, that's unphysiological, and we treat it. So what's your options for treating a free water deficit? Free water, yeah. So we give IV free water. So we get liters at a time, and we infuse this stuff down the central line. This also caused pharmacy to go apeshit when they found out we were infusing free water into people.
Why not just add NG to it?
We find that we can't get enough in, so it doesn't allow us to tailor it so much, particularly with the GI patients. So if they've got any GI upset and they're not absorbing, we struggle to get enough in. So we just put an IV. It's much more titratable. So we get this stuff off license. You can see it says not for direct IV administration, but it's fine. So if you imagine your flow rate through the SVC is at least half your cardiac output, so there's 2.5 liters a minute coming through that. So infusing a couple of hundred mils an hour of IV water does not cause rhabdomyolysis. It's completely safe. So other places seem to use 5% dextrose for this, which is a horrible thing to do in someone that's already hypokalemic. And you have to remember that if you want these people to pee, you can't have their plasma osmolality high, because their brain will stop them peeing. It wants to retain water. So if they're hypernatremic and you infuse glucose into them and they've got a high urea, they won't pee. So you have to keep their sodium down and their glucose down for this to work. So we give them IV water. So this is our strategy for deresuscitation. We give them lots of furosemide, up to about 2 grams a day. If the furosemide doesn't work, we give them some potassium carbonate. If that doesn't work, we dialyze it. We don't tolerate potassiums of less than 3.5. We don't tolerate sodiums greater than 147. We don't tolerate base deficits because they're unphysiological. So we use a combination of furosemide, potassium carbonate, water, and hydrochloric acid, and you can get people really negative with this. This is a good example of someone that we got repatriated. This is a negative 16.5 liter fluid balance in 24 hours. That's pretty hardcore. I think that's probably our record. This was someone that arrived, was repatriated post cardiac surgery.
So it's 35 pounds you took off of him?
Yeah, it's good effort, isn't it? Other diets are available. So this guy came back repatriated post aortic valve replacement that had gone a bit awry, so he'd been critically ill afterwards. And the worst place to be, I don't know what it's like in the States, but if you're critically ill, the last place you want to be is in a cardiac ICU. They're, in our country, they're great at getting people over their surgery, and they're terrible if they become critically ill. So this guy arrived on dobutamine, enoxaparin, milrinone, GTN, nitroprusside, adrenaline, and dopamine. And he was just floated into the unit of a bed. It's a ball of a man. So the first thing we did was turn everything off, change all his lines, put in a dialysis line. We started diuresing with furosemide, water, and hydrochloric acid, and we had him about 30 liters negative within about 5 days, and he was like a new man. He was off the ventilator, breathing spontaneously through his trachea. His ARDS that he'd had for 2 weeks miraculously disappeared for some reason, which may have been coincidence. So you can really, you can push this hard if you want to. You can really dry these people out. So a little bit about how we treat our patients in Craigavon. Intensive care, once you get over the resuscitative phase, there's an awful lot of knob twiddling. And sometimes with all this kit by the bedside, you can forget there's a patient in it, and we're all guilty of it. We depersonalize them. We put them in the middle of all this kit, all these tubes, all these machines, and sometimes you forget that there's a person in there, and you just sit and twiddle the knobs. It's more a thing if you're a pure intensivist without the resuscitation bit, and it's very easy to get into the day-to-day routine of coming around, adjusting the inotropes, changing the ventilation, and walking away. So we try and get around that in Craigavon. So one of the things we do in our ICU is that we every day at the bedside, we monitor and screen for noise levels and light levels. So out of hours, the guys will come around, simple iPhone apps, there's a white goods app and a noise meter. If there's an unacceptable amount of noise or light in the room, the patient gets earplugs and face masks to try and promote natural sleep. So we try and get them back into sleep cycle regularly. And certainly if they're awake and able to communicate with us, they all get asked about earplugs and face masks. So this is the boring side of critical care, but it's no less important than the cool stuff at the start. So we try and get people back into their circadian rhythms. We get the families in. This isn't our unit. This is just a generic picture that I took off the internet. So you have to cater for the patient's needs. And the patient's needs might not be what you think they are. So getting their family in by the bedside, they can still look as grumpy as this man does here. This man clearly doesn't want his family at the bedside. So we try and find out what the patients want. And we do bring all sorts into Craigavon. So sometimes it's a companion that's been missing out from the family. So we do have pet visitations in Craigavon. If we have patients in the side rooms, we bring our animals in for them, particularly if they're being palliated. It's very important for the patient's well-being to have animals in. So we've got an open policy. Infection control went mental when we took off this day. Absolutely mental. Even though it was bare below the elbows, but there's no problem bringing pets in. They're fine as long as their vaccines are up to date, and we get them to bring them to a pet place that they get washed and cleaned and they're brought in. Now the Americans, they go one step further, so well done you guys. This is a setup called Hugs for Horses that exists in the States that I came across. So they also bring into, for palliative units, they bring in miniature horses for the patients to see. And what effect this would have on critical care delirium, I'm not too sure. You see this thing trotting through the unit. Infection control would also go apeshit, I think, if we tried to do this. So these things kill people. ICU beds, if you leave a person lying in the bed for weeks at a time without doing much with them, they'll get into problems. So the other thing we do in Craigavon is we work really hard with our physios. We've got a really good physio team, really good occupational therapy team. And if the patient's blood pressure can support it, they get sat out at the bed space every day. And if they cope okay with that, their inotropes get put up and up and up and up and up until they're no longer dizzy, and then we stand them up. And we do that every day for every patient, unless there's a good reason why we can't. We also walk them about the unit. This guy is day two post-thoracotomy for an esophageal CA. He's at a combined thoracotomy and laparotomy. He's day two. We've got two nurses, two physios, and one of our doctors. He's got two chest drains hanging off the walking frame. He's on about half a mic of noradrenaline to stop him from fainting. He's a nasal cannula. We stand him up, and this guy did 10 laps of the unit, so we just keep walking until they get tired. So we get our patients up out of bed really, really soon, and even if they have to be on monstrous inotrope doses for us to allow, us to do that, as long as they're asymptomatic, they get up and they get walked about. So it's very, very good way of mobilizing patients. If you want to fix basal atelectasis, this is how to do it. Get them up and walk them about. So, summary slide. Critical care anywhere is an excellent maxim. We try and go one step further, and we're trying to bring it outside the hospital a little bit. But then there is a different mindset back in the UK that pre-hospital medicine is its own defined field. You have to be aware that some people's dying process starts before they ever reach the hospital, and we do try and cater for that. A good resuscitation, there has to be a good de-resuscitation afterwards, otherwise you're just letting the patient freewheel during that stage of their critical care. So if they've been actively resuscitated, we feel that they should be actively de-resuscitated. A unified approach, in our opinion, yields much better results than trying to get people to do their own thing with a vast array of drugs in a cupboard, because we find that it gets away from you. So we try and have a fairly unified approach for things, quite didactic, and we don't change from it unless there's a good reason. And remember, at the center of every intervention there is a person, and we try and keep it as personalized as we can on our unit. So that's us. Does anybody have any questions or comments?